It's time for the Sandler Training Hour on News Talk 670 KBOI. Here's your host, Jim Stevens.
Welcome to the weekend. Each week I invite keynote Sandler trainers to discuss strategies to improve behavior, attitude, and technique using the proven and highly successful Sandler training system. And this week I have a special guest. It's our CEO and the owner of Sandler Training, Dave Mattson. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Hey, it's my honor, really is. Dave has just written a new book, and the book is The 49 Sandler Rules for Sales Leaders. And Dave, I think that's such a great book because sales leaders need some rules to govern them. Before we get into that subject, though, give our listeners a little bit of a background of how long you've been involved in Sandler. How'd you climb to the very top of the organization?
I've been involved with Sandler for 30 years, Jim. I was a client. I joined the Sandler. I was sitting in a class. I signed my agreement, sat in to be trained. And I always thought that salespeople were born. And I didn't come from a sales background. My family wasn't in sales. I was supposed to be an accountant or a doctor or an attorney. And when I failed at all those and went home to tell my parents I was in sales, I mean, they were horrified. And so I had to figure out very quickly that you don't have to be born. You know, my natural personality type is I'm introverted. And what I've learned through Sandler is that it's not that you're born, you can be made. And whether it's you can be made as a salesperson or you can be made as a sales leader, it's a teachable thing. And so I sat through the President's Club and I became the number one salesperson for the company that I worked for. I ended up then going to work for a Sandler trainer. And I just thought the best way to become a machine is to work for the Sandler trainer. And that was up in Connecticut. And I did that for 2 years. And I was at a convention that Dave Sandler was conducting. He was the man. And he said up front that my national trainer has left to open up their own office. And I'm looking for somebody to help me take the business to the next level. I heard that. I talked to my Sandler trainer and I said, do you mind? Can I talk to Mr. Sandler? I went up to talk to Sandler. And that was probably 1988, Jim.
Wow.
And so I went to work for David thinking it was going to be a year. And I knew he was the guy because I had learned Sandler. And so I was a sponge and I had a number of different jobs within Sandler. I started off by training our trainers and I did that. And then I went on the road and did seminars. And so I would do 1 day, 2 day boot camps. I spent a couple of years in Europe doing Sandler.
Huh.
I have an accent, you know, I had the New England dry humor. It was a natural fit. So that kind of worked. And I ran our franchising department. So I think I've successfully been fired from every job within Sandler. In 1994, I came to Dave Sandler and I said, hey, David, you know, I was only going to be here a year. I'm traveling all this. I'm really going to go back to Connecticut and open up a Sandler office. And he said, oh, wow, that's really too bad. I was just talking to my wife and we had really a different plan for you, but I wish you well and I'll help you any way I can. And so you know this stuff, Jim. It's like Obi-Wan Kenobi saying, that's fine, but here comes a little negative cell, right? And
yeah.
So I said, well, wait a minute now. What do you mean? He goes, well, we were hoping that you could become our partner. And so I had the privilege in 1994 to take out a massive loan to give to Dave Sandler to become his partner. And unfortunately for all of us, David passed away in 95. And then I ended up buying more and more of the company until 2012. I became the sole stockholder of Sandler.
And Dave has made so many just terrific changes occur within the network. I've been involved. I bought the franchise in 1999, and the transformation is just unbelievable. Sandler has become a nationally recognized brand. And one of the things I think that sets us apart is the folks who are actually doing the training also sell. And our competitors just don't typically have that. Fair?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, we can argue whether the Sandler content is the best. I believe it is. And, you know, millions of people do, but you're absolutely correct. You know, you get in front of a Sandler trainer and inevitably somebody's going to say, Jim, and I know it's happened to you a lot of times and I've watched you for a long, long time do programs at our conventions. And you know, I know how good you are. You rock. And people will say, let's say at a President's club or a boot camp. Jim, could you show me how to get past the gatekeeper now that you've used that technique? And what they're really trying to say to you is, I don't think that works, right? And right. So we very quickly jump into role play, and no other training organization does that because right. they normally have trainers who train but have never sold in their life.
Right.
You sell every day. You manage every day. So when you say, how do I get past the gatekeeper? You will say, you play customer. Let me play salesperson trying to get past you as the gatekeeper. And the first thing is they're shocked that you would actually put yourself in that high-risk situation
right.
where you're going to show them you don't know their business. They get to play the gatekeeper from you know where, right?
Right.
They'll tell you things that they haven't heard since 1932, and you role play, which I think is the greatest, yeah. You know, the greatest gift that you can give salespeople is to show them how to do it. Just don't tell them. It's like golf. You can show me a video on golf. You can tell me without actually doing a swing. But if we're out there doing it together, I get to mimic you. Yeah. I get to show you. Then it's much easier for me to say, Jim, guess what, buddy? I saw that. I heard it. I got it. That's awesome.
Terrific. So tell us, Dave, about your new book, 49 Rules for Sales Leaders. What prompted you to write the book, and what's the basic message?
Well, you know, we had a bestseller, which was the 49 Rules for Salespeople. And so the 49 Rules for Sales Leaders, there's a couple things going on. Number one, I think sales leadership is the hardest job in any company. You know, we have this Herculean task. There's not a huge 6 week or a 6 month or 6 year learning track. Normally, there's an opening in the sales gig for sales manager, somebody left, and the owner or executives look around and they say, who's the most qualified salesperson that we could make as a sales manager? And they promote that person. And that sales manager learns by fire. They don't have any training. They don't know really what to do. So they rely on what they experience through their sales manager, much like parenting, if you think about it, right? Your first child, you don't know what you're doing. You're practicing on your first kid. And that's what sales managers do when they go into that role. So that's why it was written, is to help, I think, the most important role in that company who generate the revenue for the owners and for the companies, for the stockholders. So that's that group. Why the rules, though, versus scripts? I do believe every company is different. I do believe, you know, there's different parts of the country, and my issues as a sales leader may be different than yours, Jim. And so what Sandler taught us, whether it's sales rules or sales leadership rules, is how to think. We don't teach a lot of scripts because I don't think scripts work in every situation. But much like we learned in school, there are math rules, there's English rules, right? So I don't have to learn every rule. I comes before C. I don't have to learn all those, but when I know there's an I and an E, then okay, I get that.
Right.
So we can learn those rules. And that's what we really have captured in this book, you know, is here's a scenario. Here's how you think about it. Here's how you should react to it. Now you play your own sheet music. You insert your own employees and insert your own business, but the model works. And what we have found is if you can teach people this, they can use it in any circumstance, whether it's their personal lives or their professional lives. And that's really the difference in this book, Jim.
Yeah, I think that's so important because typically, as I work with business owners, managers, and leaders, they're in a position where nobody is absolutely honest with them. Nobody tells them the truth about their own blind spots. And until you have something that jars your sense of reality and helps you say, well, maybe I'm not looking at this right. And in many ways, I think some of the rules that you have written are that challenge. It's that thing that tells me, you know what, I may be walking into this blind. So we're almost out of time. Give us a little teaser for what's one of the rules that really speaks to you.
Rule number one, I put it there because it does speak to me. Use a common process. And just a quick teaser, I think every department in your company has a language. The accountants have a language. Jim, if I say, hey, could you send me your P&L? You know what that means, right?
Yeah.
If I say, hey, what's your SEO? You know, how you doing? What words you're using? You know what that means. That's marketing. But in sales, if I say, hey, is it qualified? I could say that to a sales force of 15 people, and that has 15 different meanings for each and every one of them.
It's so true. My guest today is Dave Mattson. Dave, give your contact information in case somebody'd like to reach out to you.
Well, you could reach me at dmattson@sandler.com, or you can go right into sandler.com and learn a little bit about what we do.
And give a plug for your book. Give us the name and where should they go to buy it?
So they can go to a couple different places. It's the Sandler Rules for Sales Leaders. So it's 49 rules. You can go to Amazon to buy that. You can also go to sandler.com. You'll see a shop with all of our books up there, and you'll find this one as well.
All right. And I'm Idaho's Sandler trainer, Jim Stevens. Visit our website at www.crossroads.sandler.com and download the 3 biggest mistakes sales calls people should never make. For specific questions or comments, you can call us at area code 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. And welcome to one of my favorite segments of the program, Entrepreneur Radio. I love this program because we get to learn more about some of the real heroes who make the economy churn. These are small business owners and leaders who grow bigger businesses and then even bigger businesses. And I'm honored to have with me a team of people who are very key to helping facilitate that growth in the Treasure Valley. Jay Larson. Jay, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jim.
Jay, give the listeners just a thumbnail overview of what Idaho Technology Council does.
We're here to help technology in Idaho start, grow, and thrive. So it's the voice from industry to be able to help grow a knowledge-based economy where you're looking at the next generation of products, services, and ideas that will come out to the public.
You're a membership organization, nonprofit organization, mm-hmm. and you really link people who are in need of talent, find talented people. So talk to us about that part of what you do.
Jim, you know, one of the biggest things we do right now is we've conducted 20 focus groups throughout the state, and the number one item that businesses have that they have opportunity with is talent. So quickly, the talent issue that's happening specifically within the Boise Valley has been around software.
Yeah.
We've had companies that have been exploding over the last 10 years in the software. In fact, the companies that are taking the place of the MKs and, you know, the Oritas and the other companies that used to be part of this thriving economy that we had in the 70s and 80s are now the technology companies.
Right.
So one of their biggest needs is to be able to get computer science software professionals in that area. What we've done is we've worked very closely with universities. Specifically, we've helped Boise State go from having 9 faculty members and only graduating 20 computer science graduates a year to having 27 faculty member, and where they're going to be graduating over 200 to 500
wow.
a year. So that's going to change the whole landscape on our talent ecosystem. Then we also did one other thing, Jim. We went out and we said, okay, there are only 7% of high schools in the state of Idaho that are teaching computer science as of a couple of years ago.
Mm.
One of our major objectives was to be able to go in and say, okay, we need to start getting computer science in our K through 12 system. Think of it this way. You would always sit there and say, I was a sophomore in high school and I took biology. I might not want to go into that field, but it gave me a better understanding of how
right.
the world operated around
right.
you, how photosynthesis work and all those type of things. What computer science does will allow us to be able to have people understand how things operate in the digital world that we're in right now. So one of our objectives now is we've already had probably about 400 teachers trained to be able to teach computer science in our K through 12 system. And we're going to be able to see tons of proliferation on that will really help our students become much more in the STEM action or the science. That area.
So tell us a little bit about your business, who you are and what you do.
Jim, we're the Idaho Technology Council. We're focused on growing a knowledge-based economy in the state of Idaho. And why this is important is that it's really generated from business and industry. So we can set plans, objectives, other type of things so that we know how to grow a knowledge-based economy, which means that we're going to be generating the next generation of product services and jobs in the state of Idaho. And that is kind of the most important thing that we have. So in the future, we have jobs for our friends, our neighbors, our family, and our grandchildren.
We have a growing economy.
Exactly.
And Jay has brought Heidi Jarvis. Heidi, tell us, what is your position in the organization?
Thanks so much, Jim. My position is I'm Vice President of Development for the Idaho Technology Council. And in my role, just as Jay talked about our ecosystem, I work with the ITC across this great state of Idaho and bringing our ecosystem and all of our businesses together in collaboration to be part of this wonderful opportunity that we have to start, grow, and thrive. And that's our mission.
And so, Jay, you are a nonprofit organization. Tell us the beginning. Back up to what caused you to give birth to this enterprise.
Jim, so it's just in a nutshell, my previous existence was about 20 years in telecom, where I ran about 12 years, ran Verizon Wireless, and I was in Utah running Verizon Wireless for Utah. And during that time, I had the chance to be able to see how much things were starting to spark and ignite down in Utah, meaning that it was about 1998 to 2004. So the Olympics came.
Oh, boy.
They had the dot-com bust, which caused a lot of other things. They did two things down there during that time frame where they were able to get this thing called the fund of funds to be able to get more money into private sectors to help them grow. And the second one was a thing called U-Star, which was their ability to get about $300 million into research and development. During all this time, I saw this magnificent start of an ecosystem down there that was just on fire. I moved back to Boise and I started looking around and I had my neighbors. I didn't have the same connecting points that we had down in Utah where I saw these wonderful things taking place. And what I feel took place is that Idaho took their foot off the pedal. In the mid-90s, we were considered a tech pole by the Milken Institute study. Utah was not even on the map at that point. 7 years advanced, we were off the map, Utah was on it. And the reason that it took place is because we did not have as strong of ecosystem, especially in the early stage portion of where companies would start, grow, and thrive. So we've been really focused on that area. I'll give you one other illustration on this. When I first moved to Utah in 1998, I had a chance to meet with Governor Leavitt. And I was talking about a double taxation thing for Verizon Wireless. But with the time, I met with him and he said, you know, Jay, I'm so envious of Boise and Idaho because you have the INL, you've got Micron, you've got HP, you've got these monster anchors to be able to drive.
Tech companies that really should be making a huge impact in our economy.
And they were doing all of that during that time frame. And even Albertsons at the time in 1998, they bought American Stores, which was based out of Salt Lake. So
right.
All of these things were exiting. But what he said, the reason that he was going to change the economy in Utah was because he was going to focus on having technology companies that went from 5 employees to 50 to 100 employees. And that was the key. So he actually hired a gentleman from iOmega, which was Brad Wiskirchen, an uncle to Brad Wiskirchen. Brad's the CEO of a local company here called Count, which is a fantastic technology company. He hired him to be the technology czar, which was going to be able to focus on being able to get more technology companies starting and thriving in that area. Now you go forward 15 years, and it is monster what's taken place down in Utah with respect to the amount of companies that have grown, the amount of companies that have been grown from being a $1 million company to a $1 billion company.
Yeah.
They had 8 of them 2 years ago.
Wow.
Out of 16 that took place across the whole country, 8 of which were in Utah.
Unbelievable.
So I'm just sitting there saying, okay, you focus on a lot of these things. So what we have to do in Idaho is that we have to continue to find ways to be able to get technology companies that are answering industry and needs from consumers to be able to get them to the point where they're answering the call and they're growing companies like you have, like Cradlepoint. Cradlepoint's another great illustration, a company that grew and had its first industry investment from the Boise Angel Fund and a gentleman who took this idea out of when he was working at HP. He grew the company. They brought in another CEO called George Mulhern to scale the company, and they have $48 million from Sorensen Capital out of Utah. And then they just got another $89 million to help continue to grow the company.
Wow.
These type of things are happening. I could tell you about 15 to 20.
And so what's your role and involvement in this evolution?
So the way that we're doing this is that we've really focused on three areas, Jim. The first one being talent and how you grow talent and how you continue to train talent, which is right in line with the Sandler training, right? The second one that really comes in is that we look at ways to be able to get capital here and the way that you can grow a capital infrastructure and a capital connected community within the state of Idaho. Because every time you turn around, capital chases good ideas. And in our society, in a capitalist society, you've got to find ways to be able to monetize these things. And that's what the Capital Connect side of it does. The third area is how you get ideas to the marketplace. So now you get something that comes off a laboratory shelf or something that goes on. How do you get that from a marketing standpoint? And how do you protect the intellectual property? And how do you make it so you're creating the next generation of products and services?
Right. And to that point, we just came off a tech to market meeting. They're just outstanding. And I mentioned earlier, as Jay did, we work with our ecosystem of businesses, small, growing businesses, medium and large companies, but is very essential. Again, we have this great relationship with our Idaho universities. They are tremendous partners, especially in that research and development sector, as well as the talent pipeline.
So you came from really a public into a nonprofit organization. What was your strategy in building this as a nonprofit?
So the strategy really needed to be bring an industry group together to be able to find it. So we're a nonprofit industry aligned organization. And the way that we're doing this is that we need to bring something where you bring a voice, which is a collective voice, because all these places that I'm talking about, you go to Austin, you go to the Silicon Valley, you go down to the Utah marketplace, they all had a way to be able to coalesce, and industry was the way to do it. So think about it for 1 second. Who is responsible to grow a knowledge-based economy in the state of Idaho right now?
Probably the universities, right?
Universities are a big player, but if you sit there and you put them as the only place, they're like an island. So it's really a collective ecosystem.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Collective voice. Yeah. And a voice. Absolutely.
And it really needs to be led by those that drive the monetization of the ideas and everything that takes place, those who are making money off of those. So it's really industry that needs to drive it. Then you look at finance and access and talent. You also have to bring the government and our state and local and federal entities in as a part of the driving force on it. And then you bring the universities. Universities are key for this. It was great. I just have to tell you this. I was talking to some folks from College of Southern Idaho. And if you want to know how connected the Twin Falls and Magic Valley is, it's because of College of Southern Idaho and how they do it. You look at Boise Valley here and the growth has taken taken place with Boise State University and how they're trying to become a research institution of distinction. What University of Idaho does and what Idaho State, it's phenomenal what we have going on in Idaho.
If there aren't talented people, you're not going to see growth in the economy. The second thing is we better have some cash. So how do you handle that?
Well, let me tell you, there's two ways to do that. Why we're so successful from the Idaho Technology Council is because our board and our leadership takes place from the leaders of the technology companies in the state of Idaho. So that's the big thing, is creating a network for those people to be able to come together and to be able to have these very wise people that have been involved in competing on various fronts on our nation and our globe, that they're coming together to be able to form strategies about how to be able to make Idaho more successful. Now, one of the areas that we knew that we had to really increase in was the access to capital. A lot of states are getting capital. A lot of other areas are getting capital. The reason they're getting capital is because people are having compelling products and services, and there are also some great leadership teams. What we are doing now is that we are now tracking through every year we have the Idaho Capital Connect Conference, and we also put out the Idaho Deal Flow, which also tracks all the deal flow from mergers and acquisitions and private placement. We're showing that there's much more money coming in the state of Idaho than there was 5 to 6 years ago. And obviously before when we had the financial collapse, that was a bad time for everybody. But now we're showing that there's a lot of money coming into our state.
Right.
And more importantly, that it's coming from some of the top venture capital funds on the planet that are investing in Idaho companies. And those companies now are growing and scaling, are becoming the companies that I talked about earlier, where they had 5 employees 10 years ago. Now they've got 200 to 400 employees that are going on.
It's remarkable.
Now. That is really the key to our economy, is the more that we diversify and have those type of companies be successful, the ones that have started with a simple idea of getting a wireless router like you would at Cradle Point, to the point where they're now an industry dominant area on the whole face of the planet, bigger the places like Cisco and those type of things. It's amazing what Idaho companies are doing now.
It really is. And so part of your job is to help put together investors with people who are looking for growth.
Right.
And you do that through your council. We have just about a minute left. Share a little bit about that.
So what we do with a lot of the council side is we will look for ways that we actually show. One thing that people love to see is they like to see how people have grown something. Like Mark Monitor, you have a Faisal Shah who helped start this company now, and it had a multi-million dollar, probably about $300 million exit. Now he started 3 or 4 other companies. So you see somebody that comes in and he's grown something that's been fantastic for our community. And now he comes back and he does it all again with starting 5 employees. And now he's up to 40, 50 employees.
Awesome.
And those are the type of things we have. Now, there are a lot of those people in our valley that a lot of people don't know about. But what they want to know is how they did it. So that's what we're trying to bring to it.
Yeah. Those success stories really breed enthusiasm.
They really do.
And optimism. So I'll have to have you help me get them on the show. That'd be good to hear their story. One of the things necessary, in addition to talent and capital, is you got to have ideas. So tell us about what you do to fill that gap, Jay.
I think Heidi brought something I wanted to make sure as I talk about this. What we have that's so important is that technology is pervasive on every part of every company. Everything that you look at, it looks for optimization. And so technology is optimized and utilized in every situation, whether you're an agriculture company or you're a high-tech company or you're somebody that's focused on finance or healthcare delivery. Let me tell you about what reason this is so important. What happens with this is that you always look for the next iteration of a product. You look for a new product you're trying to get to the marketplace. What we're really focused on, and this is that what we call the tech to market, ability to be a technology play to the marketplace. Every area you look at that's been successful, they always have pathways. So some of the industry experts say that there's about, out of new ideas that go to the marketplace, 66% of them come from the private sector. So that means the laboratory, the lab bench is at that private sector and they're working on that. What they usually find on most of those is if it takes more than a year to get it to the marketplace, then you need to look at places like the Idaho National Laboratory, look at the university system and how they could help you get those and go do more in-depth research to be able to partner with that entrepreneur to be able to get that product out. So what we're focused on is to be able to look for ways to be able to have pathways that are core competencies for the state of Idaho, where you know that we're going to be really good in these areas. And then we look to continue to build that. And we help get this thing called IGEM, Idaho Global Entrepreneurial Mission. The state annually puts about $5 million into this fund to be able to grow more research at like the Center for Advanced Energy Studies over in Eastern Idaho, where all the universities come together and look for energy research that can really differentiate Idaho. Boise State puts their money into computer science. U of I put most of their money into computer science and cybersecurity. And Idaho State has put their money into more areas within the healthcare area.
So Idaho Technology Council, are you scouting for those ideas? What's your role in this?
What our role is to be able to look for ways to be able to get these new ideas and find a pathway forward for those people to get those commercialized. We've got meetings this coming November. We're going to have a tech to market with with respect to agriculture. So we're going to call it AgriTech, and our ability to look for all of the new ideas and new intellectual property that's being developed within the agriculture space and ways to look for connecting points. We call it confluence points, to be able to look for ways to be able to have people say, wow, I didn't know that was happening place, and I had an idea, and they might be able to come for a way to be able to connect with another individual or another idea to piggyback into a new solution.
So your organization, Idaho Technology Council, you're almost the liaison and the architect for the future. Is that fair to say?
I think it's fair to say that, because one of the biggest things we have to do, Jim, is we have to find ways to be able to find initiatives that we collectively, that are part of the ecosystem, can unite around to be able to drive this economy. So 3, 5, 6 years from now, we're generating the next generation of jobs. And the reason I focus a lot on the jobs and that we do that is because we really don't know 6 years from now what are going to be the top jobs. Because technology innovation changes so rapidly.
Yeah, I think some of our listeners are probably eavesdropping on this conversation and saying, well, they're big dogs and I'm just a little fish in the pond. Do you have an affiliation or a purpose that you fulfill in helping small business owners?
That's a very, very good question. What we do with a lot of small businesses is we'll help them get connected to the right people. For instance, if they have a major problem or an opportunity, I should say, with their plan, their business plan, we'll set them up with the Small Business Development Center, because that's a great asset for the state of Idaho. They have tremendous people and opportunities to help people get their plans together. If they're in a position where they have a product and they really need to find out how they need to market it, we've got other people that can help us with that. We've got capital opportunities. If you're looking for capital, generally capital comes after ideas and after leadership teams. So what we do is we really help those leadership teams become more refined with their message and their power.
So Heidi, give the contact information in case somebody's listening and they'd like to reach out to you.
Certainly. So again, contact us at the Idaho Technology Council. You can go on our website, idahotechcouncil.org, and you can reach me directly. Again, I say this with all sincerity, please feel free to reach my cell phone number, and I like putting it out on the air. It's 509-595-0805. I'm happy to set up a visit with you, and I'd love to come see you and your company and your organization. And that's how we develop these really sustainable relationships in our state of Idaho.
All right. So just to be clear, your membership is open to anyone, small, medium, large organization.
That is correct.
All right. You're on Entrepreneur Radio. In this program, we share the story of local and regional leaders who are driving change in our economy. If you'd like to be on the program, please reach out to me, Jim Stevens, at area code 208-429-9275, or you can catch us on the web at crossroads.sandler.com. If you don't feel like you're qualified to share your story and you want help getting there, we might be able to help. Give us a call. We'll have a conversation and find out if there's any way we can help you achieve the success that you deserve. We'll be back just after this. So far, I've been speaking with Sandler trainer Dave Mattson, actually the CEO and owner of Sandler Training International. And now we're going to take a little more detailed look at some of these Sandler rules. We've been talking about the new book Dave's written, The Sandler Rules for Sales Leaders. Dave, the first rule you gave us was make sure you're reading off of the same sheet of music by using a common process. Give us a bit of a recap of that and introduce us to another one of those rules.
So, Jim, we talked about that language in each of the departments within our organization is there except for sales. And I think as we go, if I'm a EVP or a business owner and I've got 3 or 4 sales managers, I would guarantee you if there's not a published sales process in your office that everyone can see and looking at all the time, that you probably have 4 or 5 different cultures in that company, all attacking it differently. Here's a great symptom. If you want to do a health check in your company, you can do 2 things. Number one is to see how many people are actually using your CRM product. Most people are complaining about CRM. Oh, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Well, 90% of the time, it doesn't match the sales process that the individual salespeople follow. So therefore, they don't see value.
Right.
But if you could match CRM to your sales process, it's far more valuable. And here's how you do your health check. At your next sales meeting, go in with a bunch of blank paper, hand out everyone a sheet of paper and say to them, here's what I'd like you to do, group. I'd like you to draw the process. You can box it out. It doesn't have to be specific. I would like you to draw the process from the time that we prospect to the time that we're closing and selling additional products and services to our customer base. What steps do you follow?
Wow.
And if you just give them enough time, you'll find, I will bet you my paycheck, you'll find that there is no commonality with the people sitting in that room. Most people would say, no way, it's not true, Dave. Everyone will have the same process. It never happens, Jim. And so if that's true, then how do you coach? How do you train? How do you know what your sales funnel really is when everyone has a different language? It's so difficult.
You're really setting yourself up to fail, and it's no wonder it's so hard to be able to project revenue in your pipeline if there isn't a common language.
Exactly. What's close to you? Hey, is that qualified? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, well, what's qualified mean to everybody? But if you say this is what it means in our world, then you can start putting the metrics in. Then you can start really figuring out what's really coming out the end. I think most of the time, and you and I both know this, sales managers have a scientific approach. They hear the number and they've learned over time to cut it by a certain percentage, and that's closer to the truth. That's another indication that they just don't have a process.
That's great. So oftentimes managers, I mentioned in the first segment, it's a lonely place because most managers, nobody really tells them the truth. Some of the blind spots that managers and business owners have are self-inflicted because they aren't asking these kind of tough questions. What's another rule that you find can jar a leader into a new sense of reality?
Well, I'll do one that's a cousin to the first one, which is to live the process. Many times we create, let's say, the sales process, and then we say we've created it and it goes into somebody's desk, never to be seen again. You know, so I believe you should have that on everybody's desk. You should talk about it in every sales meeting. If I'm a sales leader, I want to use the terms that you've come to in your thing. Like we use pain, money, and decision. So in our world, Jim, I would live the process. Jim, what's that upfront contract? What's the pain indicator that you heard? Yeah. What's this? What's that? Because if I'm not congruent as a sales leader, using the terms, doing it myself, you as the person who's working for me won't do it either. Do what I say, not what I do. Right. That doesn't work in sales management. So I think you do have to live the process and use the words. And then I think another rule is become a servant leader. And that means a lot of different things. But oftentimes I see sales leaders living off hierarchy. They have a title and therefore you will do what I say. And there is a part of that. That's true. But really, isn't the ultimate job of a sales leader to have self-sufficiency in their team? Mm-hmm. That's what you want. And so my job as a sales leader is to figure out what do you need from me in order to make sure that we have the highest probability of you blowing through your personal and professional goals. And if I'm not focused on the people that I'm managing, I'm only focused on my title, we're in trouble. And, you know, the mistake most sales leaders make is they manage teams and not individuals. Mm. But if I could be a servant leader to the individuals on my team and figure out what they need from me to succeed, I'm so much better off.
It's a great point. I think part of that servant leadership requires vulnerability. You've got to be willing to be transparent enough with your people that you're not training by war stories and telling people what they did or didn't do. How does a business leader develop the emotional humility to be a servant leader?
Well, we can't be experts in everything, right? I mean, oftentimes, I always remember when I first started at Sandler, what I would do is once I figured out what you need, yes, am I vulnerable? Absolutely. Should I be afraid of saying, I don't know? No. I think we have to be comfortable within our skin. I think that we're not expected to know everything. It's like the parent. You can't show any vulnerability to your kids. Hey, what's that? I don't know. You know, to me, I think that you can show, hey, listen, great question, Jim. I know Mary is really good at that. Let me connect you two. And so my job could be connection, not necessarily being the encyclopedia of everything.
Dave Mattson is my guest, and we're talking about his recent book, The 49 Sandler Rules for Sales Leaders. Dave was inspired by, he wrote a book five or six years ago, bestseller, 49 Rules for Salespeople. This one is specifically geared towards leaders. Share another Sandler rule you think that would be valuable for us to carry in our mind.
Here's rule number 10. Treat a job interview like a sales call. So treat a job interview like a sales call. What do we tell our salespeople? Hey, we don't want you to show up and throw up. We want you to make sure that we have a qualified prospect. We want to make sure that they have the interest. They have all these things that you've come up with in your company. Why is it as sales leaders, we do the exact opposite? We spend the majority of our interview selling the applicant on the job because we're in pain, Jim. We have an opening. We need it filled. And so you're sitting here. You look like a good guy. I'm going to sell, sell, sell. This is the best company. We've got the greatest product. We dominate the marketplace. We this, we that. And it's tough. You know, I think we should go into it asking good questions, finding out if there's a fit. And if not, feel good about saying, you know what? This is a good salesperson, not for my company. See, salespeople, if it doesn't work out, Jim, actually cost about 5 times the amount that you pay them in salary. And so if you think about that, and as a sales leader, if it came out of your pocket, wouldn't you be asking tougher questions and really thinking about asking them about their past performance, figuring out what type of clients that they actually called on? What was their average sale amount? And really asking great questions versus versus selling, and blue skying. How many times have you and I heard over the years that somebody said, what I thought the job was, wasn't there? And we also have to be careful, because I think the best sales call from a sales manager's perspective, the best sales call some salespeople make is on us for the job.
That is so true. Proof comes in when you're terminating someone that really should never have been hired in the first place. And I ask managers, at what point did you realize this person really wasn't going to make it and wasn't going to perform at the level you needed? And it's almost always within the first month or two, yet they linger on for 6-8 months. Sometimes, talking to somebody not too long ago, it was a year and a half. It took them a year and a half to fire somebody who they knew wasn't going to make it within the first couple of months. Why do you suppose that happens, Dave?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, from a tactical standpoint, I don't really think that they have the KPIs scheduled out. Like, this is what you need to do from a behavioral plan when. And I also think that a dead head is better than no head, right? So maybe you'll make it. And if I don't have a culture of accountability where I've set the expectations up front, then it's really hard for me to come back at you. I also think from an attitude standpoint, from a mindset, people don't like that confrontation. I bet you 90% of the sales leaders are hoping that you quit before I had to fire you. And that's really painful. You know, you should hire slow and fire fast. We know that. And I think if you set the expectations in the hiring process, these are my expectations of you in 30, 60, 90 days. Now all the pressure has moved off of the sales manager onto the new employee where it should be.
Because we've taken time to quantify specifically the activities I've hired you to do. I've hired you to be successful, and I'm setting you up for success by giving you the controls and guidelines to achieve your own goals. My guest today is Dave Mattson. Dave is the owner and CEO of Sandler International. Dave, give your contact information in case somebody would like to reach out to you.
You can reach me directly by dmattson, M-A-T-T-S-O-N, at sandler.com. So the book is 49 Rules for Sales Leaders. It's really how to think and act in any given situation. You can buy it on Amazon, or you can go to Sandler.com, hit the shop button, and you'll see all of our books there.
I'm Idaho's Sandler trainer, Jim Stevens. If you like the show and want to subscribe to our content, contact us by email, crossroads@sandler.com, or reach out and ask us how to subscribe at 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. Dave, so far we've talked about the conceptual, but I'd like us to get into the technical. I don't suppose you'd be able to walk me through some of your technical executions of the Sandler approach, would you?
Sure.
What in particular in your new book, The 49 Rules for Sales Leaders, points to execution?
The one that comes to mind immediately, Jim, is rule number 26. It has to do with role play, and it's called role play creates muscle memory. You know, we are trying to create a new way of doing things, and how many of us as sales leaders, we either witnessed something that we didn't think was proper or could have been done differently, or we heard it in a debrief and we jump into a role play. Now, role play has a bad rap, right? In any sales meeting, if we were to stand up, Jim, and say, hey, it's time for a role play, everybody all of a sudden is doing their CRM and they're doing all the things that they say they weren't going to be doing. It's painful. So maybe the best thing that I can do from a tactical standpoint is give you the steps to really do a good role play with your people in a very safe environment. And so with your permission, is
sure.
It okay if I give them the steps?
Please, yeah, give us that line.
So here are the steps. Here's what not to do first. Most sales managers say, Jim, I just watched you try to set up an agenda on that call. I didn't even see it. That was, you know, I think you could do a much better job. Let's role play. You play yourself. I'll play customer. Let me see you do that again. Well, just think about what just happened. I just said you didn't do it well, and I'd like to see you do it again. That is a lose-lose deal. So the best time to role play, here are the steps. Step number one is that you should always role play small little segments. Don't role play a whole first call. Role play 3 to 5 minute segments. That's all that's really realistic and people will remember. Step two, I want the sales manager, the sales leader to play salesperson. I want salesperson to play the customer or prospect. Let them see it, let them hear it, and let them imitate it. What you're doing as a sales leader is that you're demonstrating brilliance. You're demonstrating what you want them to emulate. This is excellence. This is the word choice that that you use. Here's how you do it. And so you're showing, not just telling. Next step, validate it. And what that leaves is, Jim, if I did a role play on setting an upfront contract or an agenda, I would come back and say, now, Jim, our personalities are different. How did you feel as the customer? And you can either say, well, I didn't feel very good about that. And then I know, Jim, you're never going to do it. Or you could say, well, I feel pretty good. So now I've taken away that. And then I would say, well, you and I are different personalities, obviously. What would you have changed? Because you would change something. What would you change? I'm giving you permission to change my words. And once you do that, and they always do, now it's your words. Now it's your approach. And I always give you a stroke. I say, Jim, I'd like that. That's good. Let me try that. And then I repeat it back using your changes, your words. And then I say, that sounded great. Why don't you do it to me? And then you let the salesperson repeat it back to you. So let's see what happened now. You've heard it once. I changed it. You've heard it twice. Salesperson likes that. I say, now, why don't you give it back to me? Is it going to be perfect? Not all the time, yeah. But it's a very safe environment. We're back to earlier comments where I may be a touch vulnerable because I can tell you, Jim, many times I've started the role play and I say, wait a minute, hold on. I didn't like that. Let's start over.
Ah, and, nice. You know, I like that.
Yeah, why not? Right? Hey, I didn't like that one. Let's start over. Or they say, I say, well, let me try it this way. It's okay. But I will tell you as a side benefit, as a sales leader, you should have a culture of role play in your company. You should have a goal of role playing 3, 4, 5 times a day. It doesn't take an hour. It could take 3 minutes. I role play with my sales managers. I role play with salespeople. And I don't look at it as anything but it's my opportunity to help you grow, for you to be self-sufficient. Because if I have you role playing with me, you're more apt to do that in front of a live prospect because you've practiced in a safe environment with me, Jim.
Right. It always baffles me how most people in sales commit sales malpractice because they don't role play. They're practicing in front of their clients. My office looks out over the state police headquarters, and they have this huge field where they have set up barricades and barriers, and every single day you'll see dozens of state policemen out there practice. In order to be great at their role, it has to get to that point of muscle memory. And I liked what you said, Dave. Role playing really gets selling to muscle memory.
Absolutely.
What are some of the specific steps that you think are the key areas you should role play and practice often?
Well, I think for each individual, you should first take an inventory of the things that probably frustrate you the most on what you're constantly seeing in your sales force. That'll be different for everybody. But I do think you should create a quick playbook for yourself. Some things that I would say off the top of my head, a cold calling script. It could be a role play of how you're going to start a referral phone call. What's your 30-second commercial sound like? What's your upfront contract sound like? When somebody says, hey, what's your biggest issue? I don't have one. All right, well, how are you overcoming, let's say, the top 5 or 6 objections? What are your conversation starters? And when you're asking for budget and they say, I don't have one, how are you handling pivotal points in your sales process? When you're not in front of an ultimate decision maker, what are you going to do? How do you role play that? How do you role play when somebody says, I don't have a budget? How do you role play when they say, I'm going to put 3 of you, you know, it's a beauty pageant, and I'm not going to tell you who my competitors are. So look at the most common things that are going on, and you find yourself coaching or describing, you know, continually to your team. Those are the things that you should be role playing. And Jim, one step further, those are the things that you should be role playing very quickly with your new hires. Why let them stumble into those? Why not give them all the ammunition day one?
Love that. In fact, let's give an example. Let's do a role play on what a referral phone call is. I think most people, if you ask them, where's most of your business come from? They say, oh, past clients and referrals by far. Follow that up with, walk me through the systematic process you have to get people to refer you. And it's a deer in the headlights. We just do good work. So imagine if you're getting most of your business from referrals and it's coming in passively, what would happen if it became active? So if I'm a business owner, we've been working together. What's that phone call going to sound like, Dave?
Well, again, let's assume for a second that if you're my prospect, I would say, hey, Jim, it's Dave over at Sandler. How are you?
Doing okay, Dave. What's this about?
Jim, I was afraid of that. My name may not sound familiar to you. Did Sam Nicholplitz have the opportunity to tell you that I was about to call?
You know, if he did, I've forgotten, and I'm kind of busy. I could have.
Yeah, you probably know Jim as much as I do, so who knows? Can I do this since we both know Sam? Could I take maybe 30 seconds and I'll tell you what we were talking about and why he thought it was a good reason for me to call you? And you can decide after that period of time whether it makes any sense for us to continue the conversation, because it may not, Jim. In fairness, what we did for him may not be applicable for your business, even though we thought it was. Would that be a fair,
quick
30 seconds? And that's how I would do it.
Love it. How would you ask Sam to give you a referral? What's the language sound like to get Sam to open his database and say, Dave, here's two people you ought to talk to?
Well, you can do the inner circle, outer circle from Sandler. We certainly could do that. What I like to do is, now if I fast forward, I use a little social selling as well. I would go in and say, hey, Jim. Well, let me do Sam. So I'll say to, hey, Sam, I was on your LinkedIn account. I see that these are about 5 or 6 people that have the title that may lead me to believe that those are the types of people that I can help based on their company and what they do. And knowing what I do and the things that we've done together, if you or me, or any of these 10 people, do you think maybe 1 or 2 of them would stand out that I should give a call to?
Yeah, simple. Really simple.
And the reason why that works, Jim, is because if I ask you, hey, who do you know? Your mind goes blank. It goes blank.
Right.
It's too much pressure. But if I put 10 names or 3 names in front of you that you already know from LinkedIn and say, how well do you know them? Would you be willing to give me a quick introduction knowing what we've done together? And that helps you because now you're looking at a name. And I think that's really important. And there's a key phrase, you know, you always say, how well do you know those people on LinkedIn? I don't know those 5. I know those 3. Well, out of those 3, knowing what I do and what we've helped you with, is there anyone that you could introduce me to? Who should I be calling on first? I think it's Mary.
Love it.
Would you be nice enough to introduce me to Mary?
My guest today has been Dave Mattson. Dave is the owner of Sandler Training. Tell us one last time, Dave, how to get in touch with you if one of our listeners would like to reach out, and give us an overview of your book in case somebody wants to go to Amazon or to a website and purchase it.
Well, you certainly go to LinkedIn and connect with me. You can go to dmattson@sandler.com. The book is 49 Sandler Rules for Sales Leaders. It gets all different types of aspects of technique, a lot of behaviors, a lot of attitudes. You can help your salespeople take their game to the next level and take your game to the next level. You can get it at Amazon, or you can go to sandler.com, go to the shop button, and you'll find all of our books there, Jim.
This is Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. My call is to wake people up from the slumber of mediocrity. Are you tired of forgiving your employees for not trying? Are you bored with the daily ritual of at least and just enough that you allow to haunt you every weekend? Are you ready to test yourself and see if you could do it? Are you ready to test your team? Call us at 208-429-9275. Ask to set up a discovery meeting and we'll set up a conversation. This is Sandler Training, where you find power in reinforcement. Welcome back to the Sandler Training Hour. I'm with trainer Dave Mattson. He's the owner of Sandler Training and our CEO. Now, Dave, Sandler is a trial of ongoing reinforcement and commitment. I'd like you to walk us through some of the frustrations, concerns, and challenges that you yourself are facing in life, and what things are you working on for your own personal development?
Well, but certainly what I'm working on is, look, as you said, we believe in reinforcement training. I certainly read a lot. I watch a lot of videos. You know, I do a lot of things. But the thing that I've done recently, Jim, that I didn't expect the payback, which I'm about to explain, is that because Sandler, we are attacking and doing so many things at a very fast pace. We are rolling out stuff on millennials and inside sales and sales leaders. There's 1,000 things going on. We're juggling 1,000,000 balls. And so I've gotten myself into project management. Not that I'm the project manager, but I've got groups that do project management. And that, from a self-development standpoint, has really gotten a couple ahas for me, and I'll share them with you. One is a realistic time frame of all the things that have to happen before the end result. Mm. You know, we talk about managing behavior, not results. This is a great correlation to that because there's a lot of moving pieces. And so that's there. It's helped me really set expectations with the team of what's expected when and who do they need to inform and what happens when somebody misses a deadline, the ripple effect that that causes, and how to have those difficult conversations with people who have missed deadlines consistently. And then we're talking about things like there's always parts of a project. I'm always looking about the end result, but there are things that have to happen before, midway, communication plans, rollout plans. There's 1,000,000 pieces that I really took for granted that have helped me in a lot of different parts of my life outside of just projects for Sandler. It's really helped me better understand all the things that have to happen to get an end result of whatever it is.
You know, we all tend to fall into a comfort zone of doing what we're really comfortable with. And if you're a business leader like Dave, your comfort zone becomes the comfort zone of the entire organization. And if you're not pushing yourself outside of your own comfort zone, you may get swallowed up with your own ambition. And one of the things, Dave, that you brought up that I really appreciate is having that difficult conversation with someone who is not only just dropping the ball once, but on multiple times. I don't know you really well, but you strike me as a nice enough guy. You might not enjoy having that kind of conversation. Talk us through, what do you do to get yourself to have that engaging accountability discussion?
Well, the first thing that I did is I didn't trap myself that it's my problem. You know, when I didn't have clear expectations, I had the guilt. And now it really has nothing to do with me, Jim.
Is that starting out by saying, you know what? I know in the past it's been a failure caused by my failure to be clear. So heretofore, I'm going to be really clear.
Exactly. I can blame those who work for me all day long. Ultimately, I have to look in the mirror. It is my problem. And so in order to stop that, we would say, here's what's expected and here's when. Let's do a checkup time in the following benchmarks to make sure that we're not surprised the night before that it's not happening. That was my first aha. Good. I used to wait to the end result. Now I have check-in points so we can tack left or right if needed. That was the first thing, Jim.
Great.
So the second thing that would happen is if you're not making the benchmarks, well, we know intuitively you're not going to hit the end result. And so we have some decisions to make. Is it because you don't know what to do? Is it because you just don't have enough time? Are you not getting support from other people? And we start to peel back the reasons why it's not happening. And, you know, I think what's happened, because we've published it, everyone knows what it is. I've asked everybody, is this unrealistic time frames? Are you committing to it? Yep, you have an issue. These benchmark times are the times you're going to get back to me. And then when it doesn't happen, and you're right, we all, most of us are conflict avoidant, right? I mean, we're humans. That's why we talked about hiring a little while ago, and people stayed on as employees 18 months after they should have. And so when I've clearly laid it out, now it's your problem. You didn't hit the benchmarks. You didn't live up to your side of the deal. And that's a much easier conversation for me, and I'm sure a lot of other people, Jim, versus the other time you and I had a meeting 2 months ago. I said, I like the finished product in 60 days. And I show up, you know, on the 59th day wondering where it is. And then I'm shocked it didn't happen. You give me about 500 great excuses. I buy into them. And now the game continues.
Yeah, right. We've kicked that can down the road and we're going to continue the mutual deception about we think we're making progress. And in reality, we're just setting ourselves both up to fail.
Absolutely.
Other areas of your life that you're working on, anything in particular that you'd like to share?
Well, I'm working on personal vision stuff. So for me, you know, we're doing personal vision. This has nothing to do with business, but I constantly work on my golf game because I am poor and I don't get any better because I don't do it enough. But I've really found if I use the Sandler principles and really start to just do small practice things. I mean, Jim, I made this mistake. It's interesting how your business teachings are in your personal life. I would go in with 100 balls in the driving range and I would hit 10 balls of each of my clubs. I would learn nothing. Now I drop 10 balls and I only hit my 9-iron. And so I've learned to really just focus in on laser guided practice and not letting my head talk me in and out of great shots, all that stuff. And, you know, I'm really kind of working on connecting dots. I'm a process guy, but I'm also a dot connector. Mm-hmm. And when I want to do that, it's very easy for me. But I've just realized over time that I turn that off in other parts of my life and there's no reason for it. And it's really been an aha year for me on that.
You know, Dave is one of the most visionary people I know. So I'm a little bit surprised that you haven't had a priority on personal vision. So talk to us about the dichotomy between being a visionaire when it comes to my business, but in my personal life, I haven't really focused on that.
Well, as you know, from all the things that are happening over the last 7-8 years, I have a very clear vision of what Sandler should be, what Sandler's going to be, and how we're going to get there.
Right.
I certainly have a vision of this is what I'm going to retire. Here's what I'm doing. But I've got 5 kids. And what I realized was I was focused 10 years out in my personal life. I'm focused 6 months, 1 year, 3 years in my Sandler life. And all the other things that were happening between me and my retirement, you know, we do that lifeline, right, Jim?
Right.
Where you are today and when you're going to retire.
Yeah.
Of course, I have goals. I'm not saying that I don't have personal goals.
Right.
But to really look at where would you like to be in that 10 or 15 years out, and what are you really doing to get the business and yourself ready to do that?
Yeah.
I wasn't making that connection as often as I should, even even though I knew I had to do it.
Explain that a little bit. What you're doing and how you're relating it to developing your relationship with your kids.
Well, I think most owners, let me rephrase, some owners don't have realistic conversations about business topics with their kids. I mean, there's a business life and a personal life.
Right.
I've been very conscious of having business conversations with my kids and telling them what we're doing and why we're doing it, letting them ask questions about money and about this and about that. And I think my job is to make them better adults, better humans.
Wow.
And if I can arm them with the things that I've learned, I'm much better off. When I take my kids, and who are all in their early 20s, and sit down and do a vision board with them, because I've shown them mine, and they didn't put any value in it. I mean, even though I'm a Sandler guy, you know, they would say, well, what are those pictures for? But when they did it, and they come back, Jim, and said, look at how much stuff I've accomplished and I've gotten for my goal and my vision board over the last 12 months, that's the greatest gift that I could give my kids, is to visualize those goals and write them down and create plans on how to get there. And it was because they saw me do it, but now they're doing it for themselves. It's like role play, right?
Right.
They saw me doing it, but no value, but now they're doing it on their own and they've become true believers. But I think the bigger thing for them is they have self-actualized so much faster than the people that they're friends with, only because of some of those simple techniques.
I love it. Dave Mattson is my guest. He's the owner of Sandler Training and our CEO. Dave, one more time, give a pitch for your book and share with the listeners how they might connect with you.
So the book is 49 Sandler Rules for Sales Leaders. I think sales leaders have the toughest job in any organization. We don't have a lot of training ahead of time. So we've given you some rules of how to think, and you can insert your situation and your personality. You can go to Amazon or you can go to Sandler.com, look up at the shop button, and you'll see all of our books.
Thank you so much, listeners, for inviting us into your world. I'm Jim Stevens, and my call is to wake people up from the slumber of mediocrity. If they're trapped in a comfort zone, frustrated because they're living with just good enough, ready to accept chaos and volatility in daily business and customer relationships, prone to learn the hard way through trial and error, hoping eventually they're going to figure it out. If you're ready to give up the insanity of repetition, call me at 208-429-9275. Have a great weekend, and remember, if you measure it, you'll manage it.